Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of October 2016. Welcome to episode 17 of this particular podcast series. Concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which makes this pretty much the books I read during October, which had 5 Saturdays, by the way. So it's also the books I read the last few days of September, but don't tell. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. Those posts don't exactly constitute spoilers for this podcast, though, because those are just lists. And here there's some review, some critique, some discussion. As I do on this show, categorize the books that I've read. And first are the issues I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. For episode 84 of the Quarter Bin podcast, which came out a week or so ago, on this very same feed, I read Phantom Stranger number 1. That was the first issue of the 87 miniseries by Paul Kupperberg, with really solid art by Mike Mignola and P. Craig Russell. And for an upcoming Short Box Showcase, Emily and I will be talking about Wonder Woman to honor the Amazon Princess on the occasion of her 75th publishiversary. So for that, we read the first print trade of the recent Digital First Sensation Comics 1 through 5. For here, I'll just say it was an anthology featuring a bunch of creators doing their own takes on different eras or styles of Wonder Woman stories. So check out the upcoming Short Box Showcase 47 for more details. That episode, when it comes out, will be the first of a two-part spotlight on Wonder Woman. The next episode in the feed after that Short Box will be a Quarter Bin that also focuses on Wonder Woman. For that, I read DC Retroactive Wonder Woman the 70s. Listen to that episode to find out what I thought of it. Also, for an episode of the Quarter Bin podcast that's coming out in early November, I also read the 1984 First Comics comic, Mars number 1. There's also a super secret project I have coming way down the road. And for that, I read Quasar 11, Punisher War Journal 34, Legion of Superheroes 43, Silver Surfer 11, Sleepwalker 9 and 20, and something called Torture number 3. And comics I read to listen to podcasts. Russell Bragg from West Virginia has been doing the DC Comics Presents show for a few years now. And I've been waiting for him for months to get to episode 57 because I spent a solid 25 cents on DC Comics Presents 57. It was a good read featuring Superman and the Atomic Knights. I've been a fan of the Knights ever since the days of DC Superstars of Space. Hello, Kyle Benning. Where they reprinted a few of their adventures from Strange Adventures. From 1960, 1961, that era. I did have a few issues with the story in DC CP 57 because it made the Knights into adversaries for Superman, which is not how I like to think of that team, but that's the story they were telling. And for more discussion, listen to Russell's episode on that issue. My good friends the Sutherlands held a contest recently on their Xenozoic Xenophiles podcast. I was one of the winners, and my prize was the oversized Xenozoic collection signed by Mark Schultz. When I received the book, they were 4 episodes into the podcast, and then episode 5 came out a few days later, so I read the stories that they had covered following along in the big book this time. Those episodes covered the stories on Xenozoic pages 1 through 153. Similar to Trekker, this is another indie book from the 80s that I totally missed out on until the Sutherlands brought it to my attention and then literally placed the stories in my hands. Technically not for listening to a podcast, but I did pick up Secret Origins number 10 a few weeks back, partly because I remember Ryan Daly and Rob Kelly talking about it on the Secret Origins podcast. And I was on a bit of a Phantom Stranger kick, so it was an easy 25 cents to spend. And it was a really excellent issue, presenting four totally different, equally possible origin stories for the Stranger. And each of these had solid creative teams, Barr and Aparo, Paul Levitz and JLGL, Dan Mishkin and Ernie Colone, Alan Moore and Joe Orlando. No surprise, but I'm inclined to prefer the religious/spiritual-themed origins, but they were all good. And I loved the concept of the multiple-choice origin for such a mysterious character. That made sense. And there are a few podcast-related, or I call them podcast-adjacent books. I've podcasted with Brian Hughes a few times on the Fear the Walking Dead cast over on the 22 Freaks Network. Brian is one of the co-hosts of the John Byrne-focused podcast, Third Degree Burn. And over there, one of the things they've covered is one of the Star Trek Fumetti, the photo novels that John Byrne has been producing recently. And when I saw some of those on the Hoopla app, remembering that Brian and his co-host had found those stories interesting, I went ahead and borrowed them. So I read Star Trek New Visions, the annual, then issues 1-5. These are Photoshop novels taking existing stills and shots from the original series, adjusted and arranged and moved around by Byrne so that he can tell a new, fresh, original story. It's kind of a cool modern idea, though I admit it took me about halfway into the first issue for me to get comfortable with the form. Some of the pages just looked weird because they were panels, like comic books, had caption boxes, like comic books, and sound effects, like comic books. But all that was in service to photos and stills. You know how sometimes a comic book can look too photorealistic? Well, by definition, these are as photorealistic as it gets. And like I said, it took a little time to get my head just wrapped around what it was I was looking at. I mentioned that these were news stories, but a lot of them were actually sequels to existing original series episodes. We find out in these first few issues what happened to Gary Mitchell. We have another adventure with the Mirror Universe, and one with Harry Mudd. And we find what happened shortly after the ends of both The Doomsday Machine and The Trouble with Tribbles. But that is what Byrne was trying to do, to tell secret stories or forgotten stories. That had happened inside of original series continuity. But I would like maybe more of an alternating format between these sort of follow-up stories and truly new stories, truly original content. There was an interesting story of the TOS crew having an experience similar to that of the Christopher Pike crew with flashbacks to that version of the Enterprise. That was a really enjoyable story, a very solid sci-fi premise, and overall executed quite well by Byrne. Overall, I would call it certainly an interesting experience, and mostly pretty good stories. On to comics we read right off the shelves. These are all from DC, here as the Rebirth era continues. Emily and I will almost certainly talk about Rebirth in detail on an upcoming Short Box Showcase. So I'm going to try to not include too much detail or too many spoilers here in these discussions, but there will be some. Green Arrow 8 and 9. The end of issue 5 found Ollie washed up on an abandoned beach. And after two issues of other stuff, we return to that abandoned island for these issues. And then Dinah shows up on the abandoned island. And we find that Diggle is also on the abandoned island. And there's a robot bear on the abandoned island, too. So all of that was unexpected. As a matter of fact, this abandoned island has a ton of people on it. The comment is made in one issue that they've gone from middle of nowhere to the center of everything. The island is, in fact, a laboratory for high-tech experimentation, which the Ninth Circle was using for their nefarious purposes. But the Ninth Circle has been defeated, so the issue of what will happen to the island and its technology is our next worry. Wonder Woman 7 and 8. In the current day, issue 7 Cheetah and Diana rescue a bunch of girls from a warlord, who also has Steve Trevor captured. Trevor is going to be sacrificed to Urzgartaga as a way of giving that demon a human form. Issue 8 was an interesting interlude, the origin story of Barbara Minerva, eventually Dr. Minerva, eventually Cheetah. She was a child with a wild imagination, then a young archaeologist on the rise, with a fixation on the legendary Amazons. She actually finds Paradise Island, but when she gets there, it's totally empty. It's been abandoned. DC Bombshells 18. This is part 2 of the Uprising storyline. We ended the last one with the bombshell saving the people in the Berlin ghetto with a little magical help through some shenanigans. They end up in Atlantis. And after Mira fights off her sister over the throne of Atlantis, everyone gets to take a deep breath, spend a little quality time with their main squeezes. And then we meet the next bombshell, Queen Mari of Zambezi, better known as Vixen. And on to the regular reading that I did. Last month, I covered a comic series from an Indian publisher called Empire of Blood. That actually reminded me that I had read a book by an Indian creator a few months before on my Nook. That was Snake Woman No. 1. It was created by an Indian filmmaker based on Hindu mythology. Its main creators are mainstream comic guys, Zeb Wells and Michael Gatos, but most of the other talent is Indian, and the guys running the company are Indian. So after that interesting experience of reading Empire of Blood, I checked to see if more of this series was out there. I had read issue 2, and then this month I read Snake Woman 3 through 6. The story is quite interesting and definitely reflects Indian culture and folklore. We have a never-ending battle between reincarnated forces. Our lead character is Jessica Patterson, a student and waitress, whose identity as the Snake Woman first manifested in issue 1. She has murdered the British captain Jonathan Harker in every prior incarnation. But this time, he and the rest of the mysterious organization, the 68, are aggressively hunting her. Harker is the only one of any of these people who brings his memories of his past lives with him to every new incarnation. And now, he considers that a curse. He wants to fight fate to somehow change the results this time around. So, similar to Empire of Blood, the Brits are the bad guys. There is some karmic imperial colonization retribution going on here. The series overall is a bit of a slow burn, but the story is interesting. By the way, if you do a search for these issues of Snake Woman, note that the covers can be provocative, to say the least, but not to disappoint you, the inside art is just not that sexy. It's standard comic book fare. So don't be deceived by those covers. I mentioned last month the nice care package that I got from Dr. Ange. As you well know, Dr. Ange is a Major League Supergirl fan from way back, and much of that care package featured books featuring the Maid of Might. But it wasn't completely Supergirl, because he also sent along The Destructor, issue 1. This is an Atlas comic from 1975 by Archie Goodwin, Steve Ditko, and Wally Wood. So it was pretty solid. True professionals, and it's a decent book for a mid-70s second-tier publisher. This version of Atlas Seaboard existed for about 10 months during 1975, and this title lasted 4 issues. The specifics of this origin was different from Peter Parker, but the similarities are clear. Jay Hunter is a young kid doing deliveries for the mob, but one day he sees more than he should. He heads back to his father's super science lab, but the mobsters find him and shoot up the place, gravely wounding both Jay and his dad. To save his son, the dying father pours his super serum down his son's throat, which not only saves him, but gives him superpowers. And he becomes a one-man mob buster. So sort of a standard story, but really dynamic art. Ditko and Wood, a pretty great combination. But of course there was a Supergirl book or two in there as well. In this case, Supergirl 14 from 1983. This is more from the Kupperberg, Infantino, Ochsner era, a few issues after it stopped being the Daring New Adventures. And it's her second issue with a new costume that loses the asymmetrical S logo over the heart look that I really dug. This one is interesting, the S logo back-centered on her top, but it seems slightly higher up, you know, nearer to her upper chest and her neck area. Almost as if it's part of where the cape comes over her shoulders. And her skirt seems to be pretty short, or maybe that's just what you get for working in Chicago, the Windy City, if you know what I'm saying. But no matter what the specifics of the costume are, Infantino is drawing it, and so it looks great on her. The issue itself was fine. The villain is Black Star, a powerful gravity manipulator who is also a Nazi and who may in fact be related to one of Supergirl's Jewish neighbors. And in addition to his favorite character, Dr. Ange made sure to include a book or two featuring my favorite character, including Astonishing Tales number 5 from 1971, complete with a 15-cent cover price. Or as I call it, the good old days. This is from the era when the book was half Kazar and half Doctor Doom. Or better put, half Kazar and half Doctor Doom! I did read the Kazar story and, I don't really need to read any more Kazar stories. But the issue was saved. Saved, I tell you! By the final 10 pages of the story. A Doctor Doom versus Red Skull face-off. Doctor Doom takes a vacation at the start of the issue on the French Riviera. Yeah, but somehow the beaches, the sand, and the sun don't exactly work for him. But he has gone long enough for the Red Skull to move in and completely conquer Latveria. Doom is attacked as soon as he lands in the area of Castle Doom, after deciding that maybe next time he leaves, he'll organize a party and celebrate his return. Which seems reasonable. His people obviously love him. I mean, who wouldn't? You know, but he's probably the best party planner in Latveria. Which is kind of a burden if you think about it. Well, Doom dispatches the Skull after a pretty good, as you would imagine, fight scene. And what I liked about this is that even though my view of Doom as misunderstood antihero is not quite the standard take in the Marvel U, when you pit him against the Red Skull, you do root for Doom. Trust me, if you don't root for Doom, he'll know about it, and you'll regret not rooting for him. So everybody, let's give a hearty...
Hail Doom!
Hail Doom!
When Dr. Ange's packet arrived, I mentioned on the last episode how generous our New England listeners have been. Before that episode was even released, the Midwesterners must have felt a disturbance in the Force, that they needed to reclaim their mantle. So whatever his motivations may have been, Iowa's Joe Crawford totally got it done. He sent a ton of books, from a range of publishers, a range of genres, including Little Lulu 217. This one is from 1974, so it's quite possible that this is actually a reread from my distant past. I did not have a recollection of reading this particular comic, but I did read a ton of kids' books back when I was a kid. The opener, the Little Lulu story, was 8 pages, longer than a lot of the kids' stories I read, but it was good with consistent themes of friendship and jealousy. Some of the jokes didn't hit, but enough did that I found it entertaining enough. The issue had a couple of shorter stories featuring the title character, and again, entertaining enough. The Witch Hazel story came up a little short. Porky Pig 101. This is from 1981, from the Whitman run. A nice range of stories from 7 pagers to 4 pagers, and Porky is the lead in all of them, which does not always happen in these kiddie comics. This one had some absurd premises, and I mean more absurd than Daffy Duck or Bugs Bunny. But that doesn't matter for most kids. What matters is are the stories funny? And for the most part, these ones mostly were. I dropped this off in the waiting room when I had a doctor appointment, and on my way out after the appointment, a little girl in the waiting room was reading the comic. So it got grabbed off the magazine rack pretty quickly, and that made me smile. I'm guessing that at this point, Iowa's Joe was worried about the amount of kid-friendly content in the care package, so he made up for it by also including the first two issues of a brand new 2016 Dynamite series. Solid Halloween reading, actually. We're talking Vampirella 1 and 2. In this series, our titular vampire has moved to Hollywood, and pretty much as soon as she arrives, she becomes a social media superstar. She's captured on video dispatching a home invader. Of course, her traditional outfit does lend itself to being noticed. She finds that being a celebrity does cramp her vampiric lifestyle just a bit, and she does seem to have a mysterious enemy out there, a woman named Slade, who seems to be taunting her, perhaps stalking her. These are the first two stories I've ever read featuring Vampy, and maybe next Halloween, I'll read a few more. All right, time to play a promo here, and when we come back, we'll talk about trades, miniseries, long runs, and graphic novels that I read.
It was 1938. The country continues its slow recovery from the Great Depression, while war clouds loom throughout Asia and German aggression builds in Europe. Americans seek comfort and distraction. It was a time when the most popular form of entertainment was radio. But a new form had been growing steadily and was set to explode. It was to become the golden age of the American comic book.
My name is Chris.
And my name is Mike. Please join us as we explore comics in the golden age between 1938 and 1955. All genres will be discussed, from superheroes to crime, horror, science fiction, humor, and western.
So join us for the Comics in the Golden Age podcast, available through iTunes and Stitcher, and visit us on Facebook or at comicsinthegoldenage.com.
And we're back. And last up, the trades and graphic novels, miniseries, long runs that I read. Every time I think I'm out of amalgam once and for all, I find more. Fortunately, that is usually for 25 cents. That helps ease the pain a bit. And last month, I found three more. Super Soldier, Man of War. This was an untold story, quote-unquote, from World War II, written and drawn by Dave Gibbons with a plotting assist from Mark Waid. The Cap-Superman amalgamation leads a battle against the Nazis along with Sergeant Rock and his Howling Commandos. The episode starts in the Metropolis clubhouse of the All-Star Winners Squadron with American Bell, Brooklyn Barnes, the Aqua Mariner, and the Human Lantern. And there was a great appearance by the French resistance leader, Mademoiselle Peggy. Thorion of the New Asgods. Obviously, this is Thor and Orion. And I admit that I wasn't in love with all of the amalgams in this book. There actually aren't that many. The big bad is Thanaseed, and he's using Lok Desad in his fight against Odin One-Eye, the High Father of New Asgard. But it was a really good story. It was Giffen and JRJR doing their best to be reminiscent of Jack Kirby, telling a grand story with a grand sweep on a grand scale. This one did have a cool ending, too, with Orion being turned into the Celestial. That was cool. In this world, Lois Lane is married to Lex Luthor, who, spoilers, turns out to be the big baddie in the story, heading to Washington to take over with the super robot he's constructed from alien metal. The story ends with the final proclamation that even Super Soldier will be powerless before the might of Ultra Metallo. Good story, fun, dramatic, and adventurous. Bat-Thing. As an unapologetic fan of Man-Bat, I totally enjoyed this one, because other than the visuals on a few panels and one specific line of narrative, this was pretty much a traditional Man-Bat story. And the two POV characters are Montoya and Bullock, very mildly amalgamated. And it's about Man-Bat. I mean, Bat-Thing. He's named Kirk, and the story involves protecting his wife, Francine. Seriously, I suspect that Larry Hama had written a one-off Man-Bat story, and it got pulled out of a drawer and mildly amalgamated for this issue. I'm curious if any fans of Man-Thing in particular, or Swamp Monsters in general, have read this and what they thought of it. Again, I liked it because I like Man-Bat. And this was 95% a Man-Bat story. And then I read a related book from a year later, Unlimited Access, number 4. Also a joint Marvel-DC production. And don't you wish you could ever say that again these days? This was a 4-issue mini that was released a year or so after the final amalgam issues, but revisits the concept. It's a crossover between the two universes, with the heroes going up against a team of Magneto and Darkseid. The only thing that can save the day for the heroes is for them to amalgamate. And so we get Red Wing, Green Goliath, Wonder Wasp, Captain America Jr., Thor-El, Jean Black, and Quick Freeze. And of course, at the end, Magneto and Darkseid fall into mistrust, and that certainly aids the good guys in their victory. It was a good way to, at least as far as I'm concerned, a good way to wrap up the Amalgamverse once and for all. For all I know, there were more Amalgams, I don't know, but for me, this is like when I read those New Universe graphic novels. There was some new U content after that, but for me, those graphic novels, The Pit and The Draft, were the end. And for me, Amalgam is over. I enjoyed most of it, but no more chasing, no more worrying. We're done. The Paybacks, 1 through 4, from Dark Horse, from just about a year ago, and from Iowa's Joe Crawford. Let's face it, being a superhero is expensive. Sometimes heroes take out loans to pay for their super stuff, and when they can't pay their loans off, they get a visit from the world's first and best superhero repo team. Becoming a hero has a price. The Paybacks are the team that collect it. Obviously, that's an awesome premise, especially for someone like me with a business orientation. There's a difference between realistic and reasonable, and this to me is reasonable. Debt is a way of life for every business, and by itself, it's not a bad thing, but debt does carry with it an implicit risk. In our world, that risk involves lower credit ratings, foreclosures, or broken fingers, depending who you're borrowing from. But in the world of the Paybacks, it involves a super team repossessing whatever tech or other expensive stuff the loan was used to purchase. And this process often involves consequences of a fisticuff nature. And if the hero can't pay, then they become part of the team. And if they try to quit the team, well, think Suicide Squad. The overall arc of these 4 issues involves the team finding their targets already dead when they arrive for the repo job. So there's a leak on the team or something else troublesome is happening. And the story itself is quite good. I had heard good things about this comic last year when it was fresh. And this read did live up to those expectations. The book reminded me of the best of the Amalgam books, because these are full of comic book archetypes, such as the Soviet Nunchuck and the British Batman analog called the Night Knight. And there is a 90s-tastic character actually called Blood Pouch. And when they introduce new characters, they give that classic 1-2 sentence introduction in a text box. My favorite of these was for the character Killer Queen, Dynamite with a laser beam. There was a bit of a cliffhanger after issue 4, after which the series was canceled by Dark Horse. The creators say they have hopes to continue the series elsewhere, but from what I can tell, that hasn't happened yet. The Joe Crawford parcel also included James Tynion IV's apocalyptic miniseries Cognetic 1 through 3. I had to read this one pretty quick after the pile of books arrived, because as soon as Emily saw it, she claimed it. She's like Tynion's work with Constantine, and I had to promise to get it to her as soon as I read it, and to read it soon. It's the tale of impending apocalypse, but it's an apocalypse of the mind as much as anything else. There is an ancient being with great psychic power returning to Earth after a 2,300-year absence. The being originally took control of a dozen or so humans, and each has the ability to take control of huge numbers of humans. One of them, maybe only one, seems to be sort of on humanity's side, in terms of not wanting to destroy the Earth, at least. Mostly the beings say they just want to right the course of history, which involves a lot of human deaths. So they're working sort of a Ra's al Ghul-style plot. This is a different kind of horror story, a different kind of end-of-the-world story. But it's a good horror story, and an interesting end-of-the-world story. One more bunch of books that came from Joe was the 2012 IDW run of a beloved old-timey character, Popeye, 1, 9, 10, and 11. These were fun throwbacks, one-off stories, no continuities, no arcs. Now, I've never been a really big fan of Popeye, either the old comics or the cartoons. I know he's a beloved character, but not so much beloved by me. It was always just a little too... I don't know, I can't really say. It just never really worked for me as a concept. But these newer stories were more modern, and that helped. There were some backups in most of the issues featuring characters that I guess are from the wider Popeye-verse, but I had no connection to those people. They were blank slates to me. But again, not bad. The issues also featured, by the way, good quality printing and really high quality paper. That was specifically noticeable. So again, generally, characters I don't love, but these were decent comics nonetheless. And I definitely think that they would appeal to the younger set. Jazz Age Chronicles 1 through 9. This was a comic that I picked up a few issues of when it was new in 1989. But between my busy schedule as a CPA and the spotty distribution that black and white indies sometimes got, I only have 3 of these issues in my collection, and I have never, ever seen any of the others in the wild. I had just honestly assumed that I'd never have the chance to read those issues I'd missed. And this is where Hoopla came to my rescue. I was so stoked to find these on the app, shocked that I found them, really. And this was the entire run of the series, including the preview stories that had appeared beforehand in Caliber Press anthologies. These are stories that take place in the 1920s, starring gruff PI Ace Mifflin. The setup is that he's a lower-class, lower-rent guy who ends up doing investigations regarding upper-class, upper-crust clientele, bankers, politicians, a European baroness or two, and a recurring character of an adventurous archaeology professor. That guy actually is pretty close to the co-lead, the professor character, and yes, he does have that Indiana Jones feel, and he's pretty wicked with a boomerang. So these two guys, the PI and the professor, battle possibly supernatural enemies across the USA. Vampires, magic flowers, and other strange goings-on. This was one of those books from the past that when you find it again and read it 25 years later, you worry about being disappointed. But that did not happen this time. I was so glad that I found these and so glad that I read them. And a little bit more Halloween Times type of reading. The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, 1 through 6. If Afterlife with Archie was the Archieverse version of a zombie movie, this is the Archieverse version of the Spawn of Satan movie. This is similar to, say, Rosemary's Baby or The Omen, movies like that. In this version, Sabrina is a half-witch, half-human, who at 16 has chosen to join the family coven. But these are not the modern take on witches, women who love nature, worship Gaia the Earth Mother, and just want to do good to all. No, these witches are legitimately evil. They worship the literal devil. The literal devil who is the enemy of God and hates Jesus. There are upside-down crosses, mockeries of the Eucharist and baptism. It's a story of old-school devil worship. And it is intense, to say the least. And we learn that Betty and Veronica are witches in their own right, but in a different coven. And under the leadership of the Golden Age character Madame Satan, they may be going to war against Sabrina's coven. I'm not sure that I enjoyed reading this in the strict sense. I don't know that that's the right word. But I did appreciate it. I appreciated the boldness of what it was doing. And considering it comes from Archie, it is such an unexpected book. Also, for Halloween Times reading, I picked up Day Men 1 through 8. In this world, the world is controlled by 50 old families, which are in fact vampiric families. But of course, each member of the family sleeps an average of 12 hours a day, and they all do it at the same time. That is one of the drawbacks of being a vampire. Between an entire world of time zones, some of these houses of vampires are always asleep when some of the other houses are awake and vice versa. So to facilitate communication between the houses, as well as just handling vampire business that happens to occur during, I don't know, the sunlight hours, each of the houses has a human working for them who's pledged to their house to serve and protect the family while they sleep. And these are the Daymen. In this series, we follow the work of David Reed, the Dayman for the Virgo family of vampires. And after centuries of a tenuous peace, a vampire war is coming. And David finds himself, as a human, albeit a highly trained and slightly enhanced human, having no chance in a war against vampires. I really enjoyed this story. Now, I'm not exactly a vampire expert by any stretch of the imagination, but in the vampire novels and comics that I've read, I've never run into this idea before where the focus is on the necessary human beings within vampire society. It just struck me as a very fresh take on a genre that has seen many, many iterations in the last quarter century. It's always nice to run into something you haven't quite seen before, and this one was that. So the concept was new, or at least new to me, and the details themselves were solid as well. Daymen was a very good idea, executed really well. I've mentioned before that I had loaded up my Nook a few months ago with a bunch of stuff from the Digital Comic Museum, digitalcomicmuseum.com. These are public domain digital books from the 40s and 50s. And I read some more of those. Future World 1 and 2. This is a comic from 1946, and it is an odd one. I hope Kyle Benning approves. This one focused on science-based stories and science-based nonfiction as well. So it seemed to have that educational mission as well as entertainment. Over the course of these two issues, there are stories about proximity fuses, code-breaking, telegraphs, radar, and atomic energy. It was also a load of one-pagers discussing strange patents that have been awarded, or looks into the potential future with some hypothesized technologies. And 70 years later, some of these we have, and some not quite yet. Among those future technologies that were discussed were underwater oceanic subways, smoke detectors, and automatic pin setters in bowling alleys. Again, a total change of pace, and I would even say an interesting golden age change of pace. And another of my hoopla finds, Archie 75, Jughead. As I've said before, Hoopla has tons and tons of Archie comics available. This is another of the Archie 75 collections, pulling in a range of stories from a particular title's history. This one has about a dozen stories, most in the 6 to 8 page range, from the Jughead title. There's a story from issue number 1 from 1949, with stories from every decade into the 2000s. There were a couple from the 1960s that were pretty funny, as well as a great story from 93, where Jughead's sister is born. That happened well after I was out of regularly reading comics, probably by at least 15 years. But that story worked. It had a lot of emotion and a whole lot of funny. Between Hoopla and other resources, there is a lot more Archie coming your way on this podcast down the road, just so you know. I did want to mention one comics-related book that I read, a comic-themed art book. It was The Art of Archie, the covers, and showed and discussed covers over, again, the 75 years of Archie comics that were iconic or classic or just funny or important in some way. They also included profiles on a half dozen or so longtime cover artists throughout the history of Archie publications. So it's a fun book to read, very well organized, and it was a nice way of surveying the artistic history of the company. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, I enjoyed a lot of what I read of Xenozoic Tales, love Jazz Age Chronicles. Those Femeni were interesting. And Secret Origins 10 with the Phantom Stranger, that is excellent. Some of those Halloween reads were really good. And it's possible I'm being influenced by the season. I really liked Daymen, and the best issue of that was number 3, which ended with a surprise twist, something revealed to us readers, not yet revealed to the main characters. But for favorite single issue of the month, I'm sticking with Halloween, and I'm going with Chilling Adventures of Sabrina number 6, which told the secret origin of Salem the Cat. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I've mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. I've mentioned this the last few months, but for those of you on Twitter, the Relatively Geeky Network has its own dedicated Twitter account now. Follow us at relatively_geek. Yes, that was the best Twitter account I could find. Again, relatively_geek. Thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.
And when I say doctor, y'all say doom. Doctor.
Doom.
Doctor.
Doom.
And when I say hail, y'all say doom. Hail.
Doom.
Hail.
Doom.